talk about copyright. Copyright's most fascinating. You know, it exists for free. It lasts for 50 or 70 years beyond the death of the author. Let's get to this this picture taken by a monkey that's been going viral. And just to give listeners some background, a photographer by the name of David Slater, he was photographing some crested black macaques in Indonesia. According to various sources, he's and they differ slightly about whether he actually gave it to the monkey or it was hijacked by the monkey, and the monkey, being fairly intelligent animals, started taking selfies, numerous selfies, some of which are actually fantastically in-focus pictures of this this monkey, and those were put on the internet and went viral, and David Slater, of course, is, like most photographers, well, not most, but many photographers do it as a passion, as a hobby, and they don't make money out of it. He was looking to stop this viral production of this selfie monkey on the basis of copyright. And there's no other place in the world that they do this other than in the United States.
No surprises there.
So it's a case of monkey see, monkey sue, as one one person put it. So tell me now, in who owns the copyright in that particular photograph? So is it David Slater? Is it the monkey himself? What are your comments on? Lita, I'll start with you.
That is a big debate, Darren. We all have differing views. I think if we just kind of import this into South Africa and just imagine that this had happened here. If in South Africa, generally, the author is the owner of the copyright unless there are certain exceptions. Now, in this instance, I know you said that, you know, sources say it was hijacked or he gave the camera to the monkey. I think the monkey hijacked.
Yeah.
I'll go with my own version.
Yeah.
Okay. So if the monkey hijacked the camera from David, you can't say that David commissioned or, you know, commissioned the monkey to take the photograph.
So you say in South Africa, if you are the creator of the photograph, in other words, the person who took the photograph, right, you automatically, you're not the owner. It's actually the ownership in South Africa in that, in a photograph, which is an exception, is the person who commissioned the photograph.
Correct.
So you're saying that David Slater commissioned the monkey, therefore he's the owner. Is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying is he didn't commission the monkey. I don't think he's the owner of the copyright.
Yeah, I mean, the debate really is, can you commission a monkey? Can you enter into a formal agreement with a monkey to say, hey, take a picture like this?
They're quite clever.
No, but they're not human.
Yeah, but there has to be some form of consensus. There has to be an agreement. There has to be a meeting of the minds that okay, the monkey has the camera, it's going to take a photograph, you know, which I don't think is really possible in my view.
Is it not an extension of you? So that monkey is an extension. So if I'm walking down the street, let's say I'm walking down the street with my dog. And I let it off the leash. The dog goes and bites someone, right?
We'll see you.
Yeah.
They see me. So why am I then responsible for my dog's actions when in this particular case, you're saying to me that I can't claim ownership of the rights credited to the monkey. That's a bit unfair, don't you think?
I definitely don't think so. I don't know if anyone can actually.
Now that you've spun a different story. I mean, in the dark scenario, we'll definitely sue you and hold you accountable.
We know that. We read that in, what's that, the first lesson in law that you... famous dog case.
Yeah.
So monkeys are different, you think?
Yeah, they are, man. But I mean, you said they're very intelligent, but I don't think they can be owners of copyright.
They can't. But there's there's a case going on right
absolutely.
Now.
Absolutely.
In the Ninth Circuit in the United States between PETA, which is the... Organization for the Ethical Treatment of Animals versus, I think it's Wikimedia on the other side, claiming ownership rights of this, and it really has caught people's imagination. Yeah. And there's some credible arguments going on about whether the monkey can in fact own the rights, or whether David Slater can own the rights, the photographer, or as Wikimedia is saying, this is in the public
domain. Not owned by anyone.
No one. So let's say you are a photographer and you take a picture, or you could be anyone, you know, you take a picture of your family, of your kid, a beautiful picture on the swings in the park, and you decide to put it up on Facebook, and someone else takes that photograph. Well, let's say two scenarios. Let's say someone else takes that photograph and puts it on and puts it on, suddenly you see them advertising their product using your kid in the photograph. Mm. Or you have Facebook itself allowing it to be reproduced elsewhere, let's say in those birthday images or videos that they produce.
Mm.
What are the legal ramifications around that? I mean, can you go onto the internet and take down a photograph and use it in your business, for example, or in your, let's just also talk about an educational
purpose, really.
Yeah, yeah, let's say you're going into a seminar and you want to illustrate that. So I'm trying to unpack this around the copyright and photo, because this happens all the time.
Yeah.
People upload and they download, they collaborate, they share. What are you talking about there when you upload, let's say, to Facebook, Maureen?
Okay, so ideally when you upload your pictures on Facebook, there's an agreement that once you sign up for Facebook, you have some sort of agreement with Facebook that anything you upload really belongs to Facebook. It can be used by Facebook in any form really that they want to. So it's very important to go through those agreements and just to see what you're actually signing up for. Okay. Whereas in the instance of for educational purposes, you taking a picture for educational purposes, there is an exception in the Copyright Act that if you're using a form of copyright and for those particular purposes, then it is generally allowed, but it has to be for fair use. So you have to be, you know, for educational purposes, for research purposes, or perhaps if it's for newsworthy, current news purposes, then it is generally deemed to be okay to be using the material. In those instances.
Just to add on to what Mo is saying, as long as you're not using more than what you need to, you're using it strictly for that purpose, you're not making any money or commercial gain out of it, and you also just credit the author or the owner, rather, of that copyright in your work.
You have to credit. And if you don't know it, I mean, you might not always know.
Unknown, then you say unknown,
Okay, so I think it's all about being fair, really. I think there's an element of the copyright about being using things fair. So not being overly, you know, not necessarily make an undue profit. There's almost an element of kind of, you know, what is the moral compass of the world?
Which is,
I imagine, quite difficult because everything is about now collaboration. Mm. But let's get back to your kid, right? So, I mean, you set it up in a private, you can set your privacy settings on Facebook. Mm. You do give this license to Facebook to use it. Others can use and share. I mean, apart from the kind of general message, just be careful what you post on Facebook. You see this now, you go down to your local shop and you see that picture of your kid being used there to what other rights are you talking about? So there's the rights in the photograph and you've got
your own privacy, right to dignity.
Personality.
Yeah. That's the reminds me of the Basasana Kumalo case where she went to a cycle shop to go buy some cycle gear, and she was just trying out some of the cycle gear in the shop, and a person there took a photograph of her, and she didn't authorize them to take the photograph, and they started using the photograph in their promotional material. And she took issue with that.
She's ex-Miss South Africa.
Ex-Miss South Africa, prominent businesswoman, very well known, quite a highly reputable personality in South Africa as well. And she took issue with them using her photograph without her permission, creating the impression that she is endorsing these products or she's associated with Cycle Labs when she wasn't. And the ground on which she took issue with this was on her personality rights, her rights to privacy, her rights to dignity, and the fact that, you know, as someone with this reputation in South Africa, she portrays herself in a certain way. She hadn't authorized this. I mean, she was just walking in there, you know, to buy cycle and they took these photographs without her authorization.
And behaved badly, and then she sued them and got a right to stop, basically.
Absolutely.
Rights to stop. And did she make any money out of this? I don't know.
No, I don't remember. Yeah. I don't think so.
Okay. I managed to read the case some time ago. They had two different hearings. One was on the basis of whether or not there was an infringement of the personality rights. And the judge also said they could have used a false endorsement or possibly.
Correct.
And then the second one was, and this was what frequently happens in South Africa is that there is an assessment of the actual damage that's being caused.
Mm.
And I think the case then settled at that particular point. But this is the difficulty, I think, with just to let listeners know, is that in the U.S., you often have cases, and they're very many of them around the value. And you hear of cases being people being sued for millions of dollars.
Yeah.
In South Africa, it's not quite the same, simply because the cost of actually going through that exercise is not necessarily worth the value that you get in return.
Absolutely.
So one needs to just kind of bear that in mind, I think, if you ever enforce your rights. But we were talking about it earlier. I mean, if someone is out there using your photograph or using your idea or using your trademark, yes, you have to go to court to get it in. That sounds like money to me.
Yeah.
Do I just sit back and do nothing?
No, you have to do something.
So how do I do that? How do I fund this exercise? Are there ways in which I can do this for low cost?
That is a difficult question.
But we do it all the time.
Yeah, we do it all.
So we got the pro bono exercise. Yeah. I mean, you're doing stuff for Hector Peterson's. Tell us a bit about that. This photograph that was taken, that famous photograph in
1976. Yeah, I'm sure.
And how's he protecting those rights? And you know, how's it working? And is he going to court every single time?
Right. Okay. So I'm sure all our listeners will be familiar with the 1976 Hector Peterson photograph, which was taken by the well-known photographer Salmon Zima. So you find that in most instances, especially around the youth day time every year, you find that a lot of parties are making use of this photograph without his authorization and his permission. He owns the copyright in the photograph, and essentially he has the right to make use of it, to reproduce it, to make any adaptations. Those rights belong to him. So in the instance where we find somebody is using the photograph without his permission, ideally we start off with sending a letter. Later, you need to just indicate what are my rights and what am I entitled to, and what are you not? What are you doing that you shouldn't be doing, essentially? So that is really the first step in getting in contact with whoever is infringing on your intellectual property, to come and chat with them, bring them around the table, get them aware. You know, sometimes people don't really know that somebody else owns the intellectual property. So ideally, this letter is to just get in contact with them and make them aware of your rights, and then hopefully that they stop. If not, then you have to actually just take further steps if you can, and just try and get around that. Yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. But what I found as well is that when you do have a letter, lawyer's letter, it forces people to come around the table. A lot of the times you see things being settled out of court. It's too costly. People get really scared. They didn't mean to infringe the copyright. They just want to stop. More often than not, they will sign the undertaking. In some instances, you have to go all the way to court.
Yeah, so I mean, we look at our caseload, and you can assess this by how many people actually go to court and go to actual final. There are about, I think, 4 or 5 decisions a year in the South African courts dealing with intellectual property. There are, and I would say that represents about 1% of all intellectual property complaints, meaning that 99% of them are settled without a decision. That doesn't necessarily mean to go to court. I think only about 10%, if that actually result in papers actually getting filed in court. So I would safely say that 90% of intellectual property rights conflicts, as you rightly pointed out, are settled on that cease and desist letter that you get from a law firm.
Yeah.
So I think from a practical point of view is to form for an entrepreneur is to form quite a close nexus with someone who knows a lawyer with one of the intellectual property firms that can at least get you to a position of being able to tell people about your intellectual property rights in a way that's, one, convincing, obviously legal as well. And in that way, get what you want, which is often for them to stop and then some kind of settlement on what they do with the goods. Yeah. And rebranding is often
quite importantly, that they'll never do it again.
That they'll never do it again. Yeah. And then you've got a contract. That's what you're talking about, an undertaking. It's a little, just a one-page contract telling them what they can do in that. So you're saying 90% of cases or so. Oh, I'm saying that, but I mean, you would agree with me.
Yes, certainly.
Okay, so the trick there is to do something, not nothing, and to really stand up for your rights. Otherwise, you'll get taken advantage of. Mm. So, speaking about getting taken advantage of rights, we're talking a lot about traditional knowledge, and what we're looking at there is rights that come from traditional communities. Many of them are have been in Africa for many, 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 many years, and have really not used the IP system to protect their rights. All those rights have potentially expired, and what we've seen is many instances, large fashion houses, or if it's African fashion, or in the pharmaceutical trade, where you come in and see something that's working, a medicinal treat for in a traditional community, in other words, some kind of solution to a problem, getting taken and money being made elsewhere using that. So. There has been various forms of what we call traditional knowledge legislation being debated in Parliament on how to protect this, but existing IP can be used to do that. And one of which is quite recently, using an example, and we'll talk about it in a second, is the Basutu blanket case, where an overseas fashion house, a very well known one, Louis Vuitton, is now using images of the Basutu blanket, which are synonymous with the Basutu culture, and selling shirts for thousands, literally thousands, tens of thousands of dollars. And there's no benefit back to the traditional community. So I'm going to, just before we get onto that, and Maureen, I know you of Sutu origin, so I'll let you lead that discussion. Let's just quickly go back to the entrepreneurs, and let's try and identify 10 things or important IP considerations. Need not be 10, but let's think of a list for an entrepreneur of what they can do cost effectively to protect their IP or to make sure that their IP supports their business model. So, or the considerations that they must take into account. So I'll start with you, let's say, Lita. Can you name one? And let's see if we can go around the table.
Okay, I think one that immediately comes to mind is the first thing, just create an IP register. By IP register, it means a list. It can literally be a spreadsheet that you keep in a folder in your computer, listing your different intellectual property, whether you've got a brand, you've got a patent, or you've got a design, or whether there's a secret, trade secret or proprietary information. Put that list and populate it, update it, make sure that you're constantly aware of what's valuable in your business. So that you also able to protect it effectively.
Okay, so if you can't audit, you can't collect something, you're not going to know it's there.
Absolutely.
And so your IP register, that's one. What would you do?
Okay. Then I would actually just come and see us, just come pop in. We usually have a 30-minute consultation for free where we can just sit with you and go through this list that you've created and just see how can we go about protecting it, step by step, obviously. In some instances, if you find that you have, such a lot of IP that you need protection for, you just take it one step at a time, starting off with your brand perhaps, and just ensuring that you make sure your brand is out there and is protected, and then taking it step by step with the other forms of IP.
Okay, so you create your register on, I guess you might not know what is protectable because you're not an IP lawyer or you're new to the concept, but what you want to do is everyone knows their business and what they think is important.
That's
in
right.
their business.
Absolutely.
And I guess just establish a register of what you think is important or differentiate your business from another business, then come speak to an IP lawyer who can help you just form a register and give you a budget on what these things cost. So, again, if you can have some kind of basic knowledge of the five different forms of IP, and hopefully this podcast will help them do that, will
Absolutely.
Help you do that, that would go as a first start. So, and then what else would you say? I mean, let's talk about, you talked about non-disclosure agreements. Is that, it's protecting that novel concept. So I think number three for me would certainly be a non-disclosure agreement. And that's just a basic agreement, but allows you, when you collaborate with someone else, to set out the rules of the engagement. They're going to give you some information, you're going to give them some information, you're going to collaborate, but you're both going to treat that information as confidential and agree not to use each other's information to do that. So those are quite important.
Yeah. Just to add on there, Darren, you know, we often find that we have someone coming in and they need some protection, but they also need funding. So they want to perhaps approach a funding company that can assist them with protecting the intellectual property. However, the main fear is that there is, they're afraid that it's going to be taken away from them. It's going to be stolen. It's going to be so. Ideally, what you know, just to add on what you're saying about non-disclosure agreements, perhaps even if you can, just getting your lawyer to come in with you. Take your lawyer to that first meeting. It sets an impression to the party you're speaking with, to show them that you're serious about your intellectual property and you know what's important to your business, and that you are willing to do anything to ensure that it's protected. That already wards them off from even trying to take advantage of the situation, and that gives you a better advantage, in my opinion. Yeah,
certainly I agree with you, Mo. Just to speak on something completely different, which we also mentioned earlier, pre-clearance searches. I think those are a mighty must. The last thing you want is to start with a brand, go into market, spend hundreds of thousands of rands marketing your product, only to get somebody to tell you that I've got a title deed to this brand, you need to stop. So I would strongly advise doing pre-clearance searches. That gives you an idea as to whether you can use the mark or not, or whether you likely to get sued by somebody else who's on register already.
Okay, so I'll just add to that. I think a lot of IP is often created in a collaborative space. So sometimes an NDA is appropriate. Sometimes, I will say, sometimes it's just not. You talk. Sometimes you don't have the opportunity to send an NDA. So what we would advise in that situation, at least in a follow-up email, just set the tone of that conversation. By the way, I met with you. It was confidential. What we disclosed was confidential. I'll keep yours, you keep mine. At least that's something, some kind of record that it would be treated as confidential.
But the
other thing is, I guess, that IP that's created outside your business. So we talked about copyright in many instances is by the creator. You commission someone to do your website. You commission someone to do your logo. And I see a commission here. Even if you pay for it, they will create it, unlike a photograph. So a photograph is one of those exceptions. And so is an employee relationship. So in other words, if I'm get someone internally in my business to create a website, the business will own the IP by virtue of them being an employee. But if one goes out externally and gets a logo created, for example, they're creating what we call an artistic work, and they will own that logo even if you pay for it. So I guess it's important to realize what's done inside and outside your organization, and then it's just simple assignment agreements to get it back in. And I guess just in terms of a tip there is that if you do that initial register, which Lisa talked about, right up early and then go and speak to a lawyer that perhaps Maureen has said for free for that 30 minutes, they can tell you where the flashpoints are, where those gaps are, so that you can go about and then get protection. You wanted to say something?
To add on, sorry, just going back to that non-disclosure bit, it's often the question is, okay, what do I put in my non-disclosure? Do I put out, okay, all of, you know, my whole concept? Do I just put it out there and then say, this is confidential? Or what do I actually put in there? So ideally, you want to put in not too much that it is, that it gives your whole concept away, but enough to make sure that it's identifiable in the non-disclosure agreement. So even if you say, for example, the XYZ concept, you don't actually have to say what the XYZ concept is. Just identify what exactly you're trying to protect and keep confidential.
In other words, whoever you pitch to must still need you.
Yes.
Every step. So don't exclude yourself by putting everything out in the non-disclosure.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes that's the thing. When you're disclosing, you don't know if this collaboration is going to work.
That's correct.
You don't want to give away your, lift your skirt, so to speak, and then it's taken. So the key thing there, I think, you've got to combat that. Well, you've got to kind of, you've got to say that if you ever have to sue on that right, you have to have it disclosed in sufficient detail so that they know what you're talking about. So often what happens is actually you go through a step-by-step process. You say the XYZ conference, I'm going to talk to you about the XYZ concept, but when we chat further, I will release further information.
That's good.
And then you have an opportunity to say, actually, I've seen that before or heard that before, it's already in the public domain, which then would exclude it from protection. So you go in a step-by-step process, and that's often the best way of, of making sure that you you don't lift your skirt but still have protection. There are other considerations, just in kind of wrapping up this little section, is it's not all about intellectual property. So people come to you and say, oh, fantastic idea, you know, and I patented this idea, and is that the end game? Is intellectual property the end game? Or what is your advice to entrepreneurs?
Well, I would, if you want to take that.
I'll just mention quickly. I think ideally what you want to do as an entrepreneur is you want to educate the public. Okay. Yes, you've got your trademark. Yes, you've got your patent, but you need to be first to market. You need to go out there and educate people so that they know your brand and they can recognize your brand, and that gives it value. The reputation that you have in the public is very important when people have to decide between your brand and another brand. So ideally, you want to go out there and put yourself out there in the public, as well as obviously hard work as well. You want to, you know, make sure that your brand is very well known. And I think that's essentially my point, is just be out there, educate the public, make people aware of your brand. Even if you have protection, you need to still make sure people know about it.
You need to make money. That's why you got into business in the first place. So you use IP to make more money. You use IP to attract funders. You use IP to show people that, hey, I've identified something really valuable in my business, and I want you to come on board, put money in this, and we can make it work. So you actually want to identify intellectual property for the purpose of using it to create more value for your business. That's what will set you apart from a Joe Soap who just walks in asking for funding. They can't even tell you what their brand is. So that's what you want to get to. So it's not all about IP, but IP is an essential ingredient that helps you to make that money that you actually meant to do when you started the business.
And I think we're talking about money in a very wide sense here. What we're talking really about is value. So,
absolutely.
So whether it be value in the form of a financial sense of actually making physical hard cash and a profit, or it could be that you want to just simply preserve a culture.
Absolutely.
So say, for example, you in the pursuit of culture, you want to make sure that it's preserved. The Steve Biko Foundation do that very well with their policies in terms of protecting the image of the late and great Stephen Biko. It's actually, you want to protect it against misuse, not necessarily about making money. The Mandela Foundation is quite similar as well.
Absolutely.
And so there's a kind of the value when you talk about making money. It's actually really it's a much wider concept about that. And that's why we have getting back to IP Live. So what IP Live is a site for commercializing intellectual property, creating value on that money. And what we want to do is get people to share information, and we want to share it in a kind of blog format, hopefully a format that's quite easy to read, easy to understand, and an area where we can house information to educate people to do this cost effectively, because people, if they don't know how to, they won't.
And it'll
eventually perpetuate into an elitist area of the law, which we don't want to get. So we talked about that. I think just in wrapping this up, I think there are some considerations to where to house the IP. What we mean by that very, very quickly is, you know, you've got a company that owns your brand, or owns your innovation, or your patent, or your design, and that company can be your operating company, or you can create a separate company and effectively license it into the operating company. One of the advantages of that is that it allows you not to put your main asset at risk in the operating company. Might be it. It might be that you want to take risks in the operating company. It might be an innovation type company. You might want to license it into other areas of business. So often separate ownership is good. And then just very quickly, that separate ownership can go overseas as well. So you can take advantage of tax havens, Mauritius, and there's some others there.
Guernsey, Jersey,
Isle of Man, Switzerland, Delaware. All of those who have setups where you have tax benefits on the IP and on those royalties going back and through. And the important, I think, if you are looking at a quite technical way of doing it like that, One has to just bear in mind that South Africa has exchange control regulations. Do you want to just, Lita, just briefly tell us about this?
Okay, so exchange control regulations are there to kind of monitor exporting of capital or value outside of South Africa. And what that basically means is that if you owned your intellectual property locally and now you want to export it and take it to Guernsey, Jersey, or any of those tax havens Darren just mentioned, you would need special permission from the South African Reserve Bank to do so. It's not something that's easy to do because you have to show that, because obviously value is going out of South Africa. You have to show that some benefit will come to South Africa with you doing that. So preferably if you know that the end goal is to house your intellectual property elsewhere outside of South Africa, you want to do that from the get-go to kind of not have to seek the permission of the Reserve Bank.
Well, you need to seek it, but the value of the IP is worth very little. So you're going to get it rather than waiting until it's highly valuable, then trying to export it and then having to pay a huge amount of money to get it out. And we're not necessarily encouraging IP just to flood out of the country. but this is business, and I think people are there to make a profit, and I think that people want to bring that IP back into South Africa. I mean, the value back into South Africa in terms of creating employment opportunities. And I guess this is something for the government to take into consideration about exchange control approval, which they're saying is being relaxed. And we're seeing that there are efforts in the recent budget speech that it was being relaxed. Right. So we talked about housing IP just very briefly. You can house in a company, you can house in a joint venture, you can house it. You can co-own IP. Is that correct? I mean, Maureen, would you co-own IP? What I mean by co-own IP, the two individuals who, let's say it might be your husband and wife scenario, or you and a business partner who've come up with an idea and you co-own it. Would you say that that's the best way to own IP?
I think that not necessarily. Sometimes when you find that there are a lot of issues, especially when there's a fallout between the parties. Question is now who can use the IP? You need to get permission from the other party when you have co-owned IP. You need to get permission to make use of the IP. So that might not be the best way of co-owning IP. Rather put in a company or in a trust or in another entity, rather than having a situation where perhaps you can't make use of it because now you can't discuss with the other party or you can't get permission from the other party.
Okay. Also, if it's owned in the name of individuals, if one of them dies, it gets wrapped up in their estate. And it could be some time before it's
and suddenly there's an estranged
uncle from somewhere
who had a hand in this.
Yeah.
You just don't want that kind of drama.
I raised you. You should give it to me.
No. Just put it in an entity.
Okay. So we've got that. And then, so last two. Let's have a look at patent protection and know-how protection. I mean, these are all, and design protection, well, not so much know-how, but these are all dependent on disclosure. Whether you want to patent it, you want to disclose and get it, and you don't want to disclose, because then it becomes no longer free and you precluded from getting patent protection. Same with designs. And at the same time, for know-how protection, you want to make sure that it is not disclosed and become free. So what would you say a tip for an entrepreneur? If your business is highly patent or know-how based, what is the tip that you would say is required, when we talk about that type of innovation?
I would say build in mechanisms in your business. Have a committee that assesses new ideas that come in. That committee can then decide whether it's something they want to take to the next level to protect either as a patent or as a design. Have a register, of all that important information. Make sure that employees are aware of it. Educate your people. Just have policies. Have an intellectual property policy in your business and say, this is how we treat new ideas. This is how you reward new ideas. This is the chain of command, if you will. If you need your idea to be heard, if you want to see it executed, go to so-and-so. People must know that Darren at Adams & Adams is the new ideas guy. If I go to him, he will take it to the committee. They will invite me to sit down, and then I'll know from that moment whether they're going to go ahead with it or not.
And I guess you can incentivize employees in that way. So you can either say, okay, we are a patenting business, and I'm going to incentivize this employee to innovate for me by giving him the inventor's right on a patent.
Absolutely.
And so that's one way. And I guess in keeping it secret is to is to make sure that internally they are that there's some kind of assessment about that person's ability to make sure that it's
correct.
It's new. So, I mean, that recent case, the McCarthy case versus Vodacom, I'm not going to get into big details on that, but that's an example of someone who's sitting in the accounting team who comes up with a fantastic idea, decides to go and tell it to the boss, and is not properly incentivized to it. I mean, as it came out, it appears that the boss took the
credit for himself.
Took the credit, and then there's been a long-standing case about that. I guess just that case is interesting because it was funded by someone else.
Correct.
So sometimes the funding, you can get external funding, and there's a whole lot of information on that. So, right. And then I think lastly for entrepreneurs is just, you know, it's all about really they're trying to use all of their resources, often doing things on a shoestring, trying to get their product to market, trying to do the hard work, trying to get it to sell, trying to make that profit and pivoting on the innovation, not realizing it might work, failing. Where can people get information on IP at no cost? And we talked about copyrights no cost, we've talked about know-hows no cost. We've talked about our team IP Live at Adams & Adams in the Sansom office being prepared, and in the Pretoria office being prepared to give half an hour's talk to someone with an idea who wants to know how to do it at no charge. Where else can people go to get information quickly and easily on IP?
South Africa, you can access the company's intellectual property office website. That is a nice start place to find information, especially, you know, what is a trademark, what can I trademark, and all the basic questions about intellectual property. You can visit that website. Alternatively, you can also visit the World Intellectual Property Organization website, the WIPO. Mouthfuls. You can access that.
Yes.
So you can access that, the WIPO website as well.
You can also go on to
FRIP.
FRIP being blog. It's a blog that's African IP.
I wanted to say that.
So they'll say it.
It's a blog that offers information on the latest developments in African IP. Yeah. Very informative. Also, you'll find relevant information there.
And also Adams & Adams has got their own website.
Absolutely.
So they got their own website, plus his IP Live.
IP Live, definitely.
The UK Intellectual Property Office website I find very, very valuable, and occasionally on the
USPTO as well. Yeah.
Just be careful of the USPTO. In terms of IP, the US is an island. In some respects, it's very different to some of the rules that exist. So our IP is largely common law based, which is from the English law. So stick to those websites as informative advice. And I think don't be scared to ask questions.
Absolutely.
And whether to help. So I would go to IP Live, www.adamsadamsip.com. For more information, alternatively, give us a ring in the office and chat to one of us on the aspects of that.